Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Kristen Rosa. My sobriety date is August 24th, 2006. My sponsor is Debbie M. I also sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous. They sponsor other women, and they sponsor other women. My home group is Monday Night Madness at 3333 Columbus Avenue, the club. Let's see, what else do I usually say? Service. I'm my home group's secretary. I've been involved in Steps to Freedom for the past 6 years. Jails and Institutions District. I'm sure there's other stuff. It's changed throughout the years. Okay, I was born and raised in Florida. My parents got divorced when I was less than a year old. And my mom remarried a man that I call my dad. He's the one that raised me. He adopted me. I'm trying to speed up through my, like, what it was like so I can get to my recovery. My mom and my dad divorced. My biological father divorced when I was less than a year old. And he told me later on when I was about 18 years old that he left because he did not want to be a father and a husband anymore, which ironically plays out in my life, not wanting to be a mother and a wife anymore due to my alcoholism. My mom married this man that I was talking about that I consider my dad, and they had my brother. And I was so excited. I wanted a sister, though. I did not want a brother. I had my brother's name picked out. My brother's name was supposed to be Kelly, and he was not supposed to be a boy. So I'm in kindergarten, and I have a neighbor come pick us up. And the reason why I'm telling you this is because I believe, you know, since I've been sober, I see so much of my life in hindsight. It's kind of like now, you know, when I'm going through my stuff, I don't see it until I come through it. But my brother being born a boy instead of a girl, I believe is probably my first resentment at like the age 5, 6. But anyway, neighbor picks me up from kindergarten and tells me, you know, she's so excited. And she says, you have a little brother and his name's Philip. And I just remember being crushed. I mean, I would dress him up as a little girl. I would put bracelets and wigs on him and take pictures. Because I wanted that so bad, and that was like one of the first things that I can remember not being able to control, you know, and having that resentment. So I, you know, progressed. I wore glasses. I was called Four Eyes. I was teased a lot. My self-esteem was so low. And I heard you guys talk about not identifying or not fitting in with your own family, and that's exactly how I felt. I could identify with that when I came in here and heard you guys talking about it. So We have a great little family. I don't remember much I love yous, hugs like that. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, because that's my perception. It's the thing that screwed up. But I don't really remember a lot of that. I did go to church when I was younger. I went probably until I was about 13. I was very active, Lutheran. I was confirmed, and we would go to like youth retreats. I sang in the choir. And I remember after being confirmed, I would always try to look for those Sundays that they were serving the communion, because the blood of Christ was wine and the bread was little wafers. And I didn't know it then, but it's like I recognize it after I got sober. I would seek out those Sundays because it was wine, and I liked it for some reason. I remember that, you know. I liked that at a young age. I was probably 13 or 14, and I ended up in my first treatment center. And I ended up in there because I took some pills. I was trying to kill myself. Just a series of events had happened in my life. And it's ironically the last treatment center I ended up. It is in Pinellas County, and it was called Horizon Hospital back then. It's now Wynmore. So that was the first place that I ended up. And, you know, I can remember, much like the last visit I had at that place, that when I got in there, like, I felt safe, and I felt like Deb belonged, and it was kind of like a little vacation, and I really didn't want to get out. I was terrified going in, but I didn't want to come out, you know. Things were done for me there. It's kind of like no cares in the world when you're in treatment. So as a reward for good behavior, my grandmother takes myself and my cousin, who's 4 months older than me, on a cruise. So, like I said, the years are kind of hazy, either 13 or 14, and that's where I took my first drink. It was a pina colada, and I remember it like it was yesterday. My first drink was a pina colada on a cruise ship, and we had our own cabin. My cousin and I and my grandmother and her sister were in the next cabin, and I don't remember what happened when I took that first drink. You know, I hear people in AA talk about how they felt, and things instantly changed. I don't remember that. I do remember playing quarters on a ship that was going back and forth, and it was kind of hard to get that quarter in, you know, into the glass. But, you know, I don't really remember feeling any different. Throughout high school, I did do the drinking thing, you know, and throughout high school, my teens and my early 20s, I drank because that's what I was supposed to be doing, you know. At that age, I'm supposed to be going out and getting trashed and doing all kinds of things, you know, so I thought. Sorry, I've been sick this week, so I'm kind of breathless and all that. Anyway, sorry, where am I at? Okay, I'm in high school. So I'm in high school. All of my friends are drinking. We're going to keg parties. I did not like the taste of beer, so I would get wine coolers. It was so easy to get alcohol back then. I mean, we would make our own fake IDs and go into stores and show them our ID, and they'd give it to us. So I was a little wine girl person, and anyway, I was proud to be the designated driver, you know, the one that wasn't drinking. And I grew up in that era, the Nancy Reagan Just Say No to Drugs era, and I thought, you know, I will never, ever do that. And I can remember in seventh grade being in this auditorium, and they were talking about drugs and how bad they are for you, and Eric Clapton, they're showing the words to his song Cocaine on there, and I'm just thinking, drugs are so bad, why do people do them? And little did I know that I'd end up here. So throughout high school, you know, I was not a good student. Let me back up. Age 9, I was diagnosed with ADD. So that was my first experience with a minor mood altering medication. I was prescribed Ritalin. And I know a lot of us, at least people that I know in AA, a lot of us are diagnosed with that kind of stuff. So when I was 19 years old, my girlfriends got me a fake ID. And that was because Vanilla Ice, for some of you that may remember Vanilla Ice, was playing at a club in St. Pete. And I loved this guy, and I wanted to go see him. And we were drinking, and I passed out before he got on stage. And I didn't get to see him. I was so, so mad. Like, I was mad at them for allowing me to drink as much as I did, you know. And I was so mad. So that was what I believe was probably my first blackout that I experienced. I experienced a few. I didn't experience that many. I did not black out every time that I drank. Unfortunately, I would remember some things that happened the night before. So when I was 22, my mother and my dad, they got a divorce, and I did what alcoholics do, and I ran. I got a good job opportunity in New York, and I lived in New York for about a year. That's where I had my second blackout. We had gone drinking in the city, and one of my roommates brought me upstairs. All seemed well. I was fully clothed. Everything was as it should be in my room. And when I woke up, I had no clothes on. I was on the other side of the bed. My alarm was going off, and I had these closet doors that were mirrors, and they were shattered. And I was blaming them. What'd you guys do to me last night? You know, that was my second blackout. That was a very scary blackout for me. I didn't know what I did. 'Cause deep down, I knew I had to be involved somehow, but I like to choose to blame other people. And that's what I did a lot, you know, throughout my whole life. So before I left, I'd been in a relationship. And my things are drugs, alcohol, and men, those three things, in any particular order. And for a long time, I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I would replace my alcohol with other things, shopping, whatever. So I decided to come back here. I moved in with the guy that I had been seeing before, and we got married. And within a year, my daughter Jordan was born. She was born in April 1998. And then my son Dylan was born in 1999. So On the outside, everything was great. My hair was dyed blonde then. Mike is my ex-husband. He looked a little bit like Ken, so people would call us Ken and Barbie, you know, and that really inflated my ego, and I loved it. You know, I had everything, so it seemed. You know, we had the dog, we had the cars, we had the house, we just didn't have the white picket fence. Things were good, and so once I got married, I'm like, all right, this is it. Things are going to be good, and, you know, like I said, back even when I was a child, I didn't think I fit in my own family. You know, I didn't think I fit in anywhere, and, for so many years, I would wake up, you know, thinking same, S-H-I-T, different day. And I don't think that way today, you know. So we got married, and I came to a point, I had an opportunity to stay home with my kids. My kids were young. And not a lot of women are afforded that opportunity. But I got that. I was home with the kids all day. And I was cooking, and I was cleaning, and I was taking care of the children. And I thought that that was punishment, you know. As soon as my ex-husband came home, I would be like, here are the kids. I'm leaving. For some reason, we did not keep alcohol in our house. It could be he knew something about me that I didn't. I had only seen my ex-husband drunk maybe twice. He had seen me drunk quite a bit more than that. But I would leave, you know, here's the kids, I'm going. And there was a little gas station right down the street from me. And I just remember, man, it was like a block away. And it seemed like it would take forever to get there to get my alcohol. I had a certain cup that I would keep. I would hide it in the garage or hide it in my car. It was my cup that I would put my alcohol in once I got it from the store with a straw, because I knew that the cops that may pull up next to me, or you guys driving next to me, I knew that you guys thought that I might have alcohol in there. I mean, that was my thinking. Like, I drink water today, you know, I have cups in my car. I don't think about that anymore, but back then, man, I would be drinking and driving thinking that everybody knew I had alcohol in my car. And thank God I did not kill anybody. And so it was like, it's just like it talks about in the big book, that sense of ease and comfort that comes, you know, from taking that first drink. And that's how it was for me, man. When I would go out, and when I would go out, I was a club girl. I was a married woman with no morals, going out to clubs, going out to bars, and coming home whenever I wanted. And this one particular night, I came home, my girlfriends had to drive me home, and I was walking into my bedroom, and my son, who was 3 months old at the time, was laying on his dad's chest, and I just ran into the bathroom and threw up. And one of my girlfriends came and sat next to me, and she said, you know, I think you might have a drinking problem. And I was mad. I was mad. Because, you know, if you lived the life that I was living, you would drink too. And she was the first person that ever said anything to me about the way that I drank. So I'm going to fast forward a lot. So there came a point in time, well, actually, when I turned 25, because I was still like, something's wrong with me, you know, the kids, the husband, nothing's fixing, what's wrong with me? I got a women's magazine in the mail, and it talked about a quarter-life crisis, and I was 20, 25, 26, and I'm like, oh my God, that's it, I'm having a quarter-life crisis. Let me read this article, and it'll tell me what to do and how to fix my life. Finally, something's going to help me. By the way, I was a very big self-help person. All the books, I mean, all the self, Melody Beattie books, all those books, the self-help books. So, when I turned 30, or right before I turned 30, I was like, man, I'm doomed. I'm going to be 30 years old. My life's over. And I got to that point that my biological father did, which was, I don't want to be a mom anymore, and I don't want to be a wife. So I left. And I got my own apartment. And, wow. I usually don't get choked up about that, but I am today for some reason. So I got my own apartment, which allowed me to drink whenever I wanted and however much I wanted to. And I can remember crawling on my apartment floor. And, you know, I was like, I can't drink anymore to get drunk. You know, I can't pass out anymore. And, I would drink Bud Light bottle, and I would strategically place my bottles in the bag so that when I went out to my dumpster, the bottles wouldn't clank into the bottom of the dumpster so that everybody would know how much alcohol I drank. I would wrap up paper towels or put the empty paper towel holder or toilet paper holder in between the bottles because I knew people were watching me. And that, you know, that again, that's insanity. I mean, just the way that I was thinking, like, people are really watching me, thinking like they know how much I drink, you know, like I'm that important to these other people. When my kids would spend the night with me, I didn't want them with me because they interrupted my drinking. And it took me a long, long time to realize that I chose drugs and alcohol because of my disease over my children. So when they would spend the night with me, I'd put them to bed at like 6 o'clock at night because they would interrupt my drinking, you know. I didn't want them to see me drinking. So I met somebody who was doing some other substances. We are an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to keep it very minimal. But if it wasn't for those outside substances, I don't think that I've ever would have come to a point in my life that I realized I was an alcoholic. So I ended up in my first detox, which was PAR. It's also my second detox. And there were some people that came in there from AA, and there were some people that came in there from another fellowship. And the AA people I completely shut off because I did not think I was an alcoholic. And it was the other stuff. And, you know, got out of there, went back to doing what I was doing before. Went back a second time, and this time I kind of listened to AA. I did hear the people that were coming and speaking talking about getting a home group, doing steps, and getting a sponsor. And I thought a sponsor was like those NASCAR sponsors, the Budweiser, the Coca-Cola. And I can remember thinking in my head, again, delusional, crazy thinking, I have no money. How am I going to buy a sponsor? I did not know that you had to go to a meeting and ask some woman to be your sponsor, you know, and to share her experience. Didn't get that. So I ended up in a, you know, fast forward, get out of there. I pick back up, all that stuff. So I end up in a hotel room down in Clearwater Beach, just the clothes on my back, with some other people that were just like me. No food, no water, no electric. The place was being condemned. And we were going to this food bank over in Clearwater to get some food. We were, you know, my main focus was to get what I needed to get through the day. And I had gone to a meeting before, and I had heard this serenity prayer. And I got to this point where that serenity prayer was coming through my head, and all that kept coming through my head was God. I couldn't put the words together. And I remember thinking, I really need some help. I need to be confined somewhere. I was not employable. I was a mess. I was a complete mess on the inside. And, you know, I had been previously, I had been pulled over for a DUI and arrested. Still didn't think I was an alcoholic. I was arrested again for violating probation. And I was put on house arrest for 9 months. Still did not think I was an alcoholic. You know, and then probation, community service, all that kind of stuff. You know, all of that, those types of things, and leaving my kids. And I didn't think I had a problem, you know. I didn't think it. And when I came to AA, I was taught that drinking's not my problem, it's my solution. So fast forward, I end back up in Winmore. That's the first place that I hear I'm the common denominator of all the stuff that's gone on in my life. I think it was like the third day before I was being released that I actually read the steps that were on the wall. I didn't know that I had been keeping some things inside that I needed to get honest about. But I met my first sponsor there, and she came in and she shared my story, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And so I started to go to meetings. But, you know, I got out. They said, hey, go to a halfway house. I'm a halfway house. I'm too good for a halfway house. Isn't that desolate women laying on the floor? That's not me. But the thing is, my ex-husband didn't want me. My dad didn't want me. People are like, we're done. You know, we're done with you. You need to figure it out yourself. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a legal driver's license and a car, which is not, you know, a lot of people don't have that coming in. So I was fortunate enough to have that. I did end up in that halfway house, and I did have that sponsor, and I would call that sponsor every day like she told me to, and she'd ask me how I was doing, and I'd say fine. I don't remember her ever talking about a higher power. Doesn't mean she did, but I came in pissed off at God. I didn't want to hear anything about God, and when I read this steps 2 and step 3 on the board at 3333, I'm like, man, I'm screwed. if God's got anything to do with this, I'm screwed. I might as well just leave now. So I got fired from that. That sponsor fired me. It's just crazy how these series of events had happened in my life. And just like I said before, you know, when I'm going through stuff, and it seems like it's the worst thing that's happened to me so far in my life, it's like I see the lesson so much later. And that's what it's been like in my recovery. So I get this sponsor, and this sponsor starts taking me through the steps. And the first thing that the sponsor talked about that I heard was the willingness to become willing and to get on my knees and pray to a higher power that I did not believe could help me. I believed that there was something out there, but there was nothing that could help me. And that step one, powerless and unmanageability, I didn't think I was powerless. I kind of thought my life was unmanageable, but the manageable, other people were managing my life. My bills were getting paid. That's what I thought the manageability part was. And so I came in and out of AA for the better part of a year relapsing because I was not doing anything different. I would show up at meetings, and I was great at showing up at meetings every day. I was great at chairing meetings, but I was taking no other action. I was doing the half measures. I was going to detoxes when it would suit me. I was working steps not to the best of my ability, and I for sure was not getting honest. I didn't know that I was in a lot of fear. And, you know, I came to a point where I was willing to do what somebody else suggested that I do no matter what. There, even in AA, even to up to this day, there are places I don't want to show up, you know? But because I have commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, it has saved my ass so many times, and so have you guys. So I start working these steps. And then I get to steps two and step three. Like I told you, God, no way. And I get on my knees, and I do step three. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. I have had to do that many, many, many times since the first time I did it. I was scared of that step because it meant that I had no more control. But I can tell you that I had something, one of my biggest fears happened to me last year. And I was so pissed at God. I was so mad at God. And in one breath, I'm like, God, I am so mad at you. How could you let this happen? Why me? And then in the next breath, I'm like, God, please help me through this because I can't do this on my own. And the only place I knew to come was AA. Sorry. I only knew to show up here because you guys taught me to do that, you know, and to reach out my hand to other people, because what I'm going through is eventually going to pass, even though I don't think it's going to, you know. But for me to help another woman, another alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous, the way that it was done to me, man, that's like the highlight of my life now. I hated it at first, you know, it interrupted my life. I'm selfish and self-centered. It interrupted my life helping other people. So I do step four and step five, and I sit down and I do step four, and I'm like, you know, I've pretty much forgiven everybody that's ever hurt me or did me wrong, because it's everybody else's fault. And this lady's like, it's not about other people. It's about you and your pattern, and for you not to do the things that you had continued to do. And so, man, that fifth step when I sat down with this woman was huge. That really started me on a path to start seeing, you know, what my part is. Sorry. Six and seven, my least favorite steps, because I don't like to look at myself. My shortcomings, my character defects, what I've learned is all of those boil down to fear for me. And for me, my fear is not getting what I want or losing what I have. That's pretty much what it boils down to. And when I can remember to pray and go back to step three and take action instead of just praying, then it usually works out okay. But I have to go through some pain, and I have to call somebody. A lot of times I have to call somebody to remind me to pray. And even my sponsees, man, it's like I can sit there and talk to them and, well, you pray and then follow it up with action and blah, blah, blah. And I get off the phone and I'm like, ooh, maybe I should do what I'm telling them to do. And that's one of the greatest gifts for sponsoring other women, too, is definitely seeing myself in them and what I need to work on and also how, you know, far I've come. There's some people that have taught me a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are definitely some people that I strive for the sobriety that they have. And then there's also some people that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've learned from that I don't want to be like, unfortunately. So step 8 and step 9. My biological father, he was my never, ever, 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 ever going to make amends to. He was my reason. He was the reason I drank. He was the reason I had felt rejected and abandoned in all of my relationships with the opposite sex. I blamed him for everything, everything. And I'm sitting, my sponsor's at my house one day, and we're talking, and, you know, it just, a light bulb went off, and I'm like, I'm willing to see, I accept that I have a part in this, you know, because I was, that him leaving when I was a very, very young child, a baby still, allowed me to play victim. It allowed self-pity. It allowed so much stuff in my life. And, you know, I came to a point where I could see my part in that, and my part was holding on to it for so long and not having some compassion. So I called him and I left him a message. And he calls me back, and I hadn't seen him in years. He would come in and out of my life, too, when I was younger, and just had a lot of pent-up stuff there. So a few years ago, I had an opportunity to go make amends to him, and I sat down with him, and I realized that what I think he did to me leaving, you know, I did it to my kids, and what he told me was that he had become an alcoholic and a drug addict like me. And in that instant, it really allowed me to have some compassion because I placed people up on pedestals, and I've done this to my sponsor. I put people up on pedestals, and then I find out they're human, you know? And when they don't meet my expectations, I do this to myself too. When they don't meet my expectations, it causes resentments for me. So that amends has been huge for me because I have seen how the positiveness from that, making that amends, has affected my relationship with my boyfriend and with a lot of other people, men, you know, women, my guy friends, women friends in AA, in and out of AA. And 10, 11, and 12, those are that's my AA program, you know. 10, I got to take a personal inventory. Like I said, man, I don't like looking at my part, but definitely when I call my sponsor, you know, that's one of the first things out of her mouth, what was your part? And if I can't find it, she usually can. 11 is the two different parts for me is prayer and meditation. You know, for a long time I was praying, and I wasn't sitting and listening, you know, for God. And my meditation I would love to say I meditate every day and that I'm this great spiritual person, but I'm not. I strive, but it's a lot better than it was when I came in. I'm not that person that I came in with, where as far as my relationship with my higher power, and I definitely struggled with God for a long, long time. But my prayers mainly consist of other people. You know, my whole life out there is praying for myself, God, get me out of this, I'll never drink again, blah, 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 blah. And then my favorite step is step 12. And I was, like I said, I kept going in and out for the better part of a year. And I had this woman call me one day, and I'd never met her. And she's like, hey, some guy in AA gave me your number. I need a sponsor. I need help. I was on the verge of going out, man. I was insane, crazy. And so I started sponsoring her. And I think I was 6 months sober. 6 months, I think. I started sponsoring her at 6 months sober. I'd been through my steps. And, man, she probably saved my life. She probably did. And I really, that's where my recovery took. That was the turning point in my recovery, was helping another alcoholic and showing up, like I said, when I did not want to, sharing my experience that I had been through with another woman, and then seeing her get that recovery. And that has been such a blessing for me, is helping other people. And for me, the service that's involved in step 12, there's a difference for me between sponsorship and service. You know, I have my service commitments. I kind of look at those as my selfish things, too, to help keep me sober. I need that stuff. But it's sponsorship that where I really, really learn from. And to see these women sponsor and to help them help other women, you know, that's it. And it's all because I've taken some different action. I've walked through my fear, and I got a little bit of courage, and I did the footwork. I show up when I don't want to. I help when I don't want to. I get on my knees, and I pray. And, you know, I learn so many different things. And when I do show up, which I do show up, I never know what kind of lesson I'm going to get or what kind of miracle I'm going to see somebody else get. And I just wanted to read. This is my favorite thing. I'm not a big book. Like, I don't know the big book by the, you know, the back of my hand. But when I read this, it's on page 192. This really helped me. It says, I came into AA solely for the purpose of sobriety, but it has been through AA that I have found God. And my God works definitely through you guys for carrying the message. There's a lot of you guys in here that saw me when I first came in and then I got sober with. And there's a lot of women in here that have helped me when I've struggled. And I just want to thank you for my recovery and my sobriety today. And I appreciate being asked to speak, so thank you.
My name is Blair. I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into 2 words, love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us all also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help, which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much.